to Motorcycle Radio. Please note, turning off this podcast may damage your radio. And here's your host, Ian Richardson.
Hi, welcome to the Motorcycle Radio podcast. I'm your host, Ian Richardson, and you're tuned in to what is probably the best motorcycling podcast in the world. And today, I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Tom Allen, who's joining us all the way from Singapore, where I bet it's a bit warmer than it is here in sunny Yorkshire, Tom.
It is a touch warmer. It's like 30 degrees or something like that. And it's like 9 o'clock at night nearly.
Oh, what is it? It's 2 degrees and it is quite sunny actually, but that's probably why it's colder.
Yes, probably. Yeah.
So, what brings you to the Motorcycle Radio podcast today, Tom?
Well, I come into motorbiking late, very late in life. And I've obviously watched a couple of your podcasts. Just to get a feel of how you do things. And whether it be somebody traveling around the world or somebody just cutting along to work, it's just the love of bikes.
Yeah.
Even here we have, in Singapore, we have a lot of mopeds, not very many big bikes. I think it's just too expensive. But even them, they actually sound like bigger bikes, and you're just like, no, that shouldn't sound like that. I will apologise to viewers who are expecting a bit of exotic bike porn. That's not going to happen. I know they've got two wheels. I know how to ride one. I know how to fall off one. And if it's not topping up the tank, it's generally somebody else's job. I'm not very technical. You read these forums and people are going, oh, I like the H3. I don't care. If it works, it works.
I won't worry about that, Tom. To be honest, we've got so many people that come on this podcast, and as you alluded to, they're people who just want to, ride the bike to work and back, and that's been their adventure. Some of the things, some of the weather they've ridden it through. Or
yes,
we had one guy who we're going to be interviewing very shortly, who rode his C90, 44 years, the same bike to work and back, 10 miles each way. And to people who've gone around the world, backwards with a rabbit on the head, like I alluded to in my first ever podcast, that might seem a bit same, but actually the same bike every day, all weathers, through
that's
the snow,
dedication.
That's amazing, I think. And, that's his adventure. And I think
yes,
the great thing about this Motorcycle Radio podcast is you don't have to, we haven't got the name adventure in it, because you don't have to be doing something amazing.
But isn't every day on a motorbike an adventure? That's the thing. I've yet to ride a motorbike that I'm not smiling.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter what weather is doing. It doesn't matter, because you ride up through Malaysia, it rains and it's horrible. It's all the rain right there at once, and it's horrible. You can't see that in front of you. It doesn't matter. You're soaked wet through. You're under a bridge. You're standing with a load of Malaysians smoking. Somebody's got a bag of coffee. You have coffee, and you're all in the same boat. And it's every day is an adventure. Whether you're And it's only because of lunatics and cars that it makes it so much of an adventure.
Yeah, well,
it is.
Definitely more risky nowadays with cars. And in different countries, it's more risky. Somebody once said to me, you've ridden a lot. Could you do us a favour? Do you think you could do like a guide about which countries ride on what side of the road? And I said,
right,
well, I probably could, but I think you're going to find that in some countries, There is no side of the road. It's just whoever's biggest gets most space.
Yes.
You know, from my experience of riding in some countries where you're supposed to ride on the left, you might stick to the left and come round a bend and there's a 44-ton truck on your side of the road and you're going to have to move.
Whenever I'll get onto the right later, but when I was in Laos, the street we were on was one way.
Yeah.
So it was coming, as I come out of the hotel, it was right to left, sort of opposite to what we would have. And as I walked, I was going over to get breakfast, and I nearly got knocked down by a bike. And I said to somebody from there's a hostel across the road, I said, I thought you said this is one way. And she went, oh, yeah, not for bikes. Okay. That makes perfect sense. Why not?
I weren't quite as far away as you. I weren't in Southeast Asia when I experienced my first experience of that type of thing. I was actually in France, and I was going round a bend on a one-way street when a truck come the other way and nearly wiped me out.
That's not fun.
And I was like, what? You know, I mean, literally, I just couldn't believe it. He stopped. I stopped. I chased after him in my... It's crazy, really, but, you know, in my rage. And he opened the door, and he didn't speak any English, but a lady came out, and I said, it's one way, and I was going the way he's supposed to go.
Yes.
And he got out the truck, spoke to her, and she come back and says, he's very sorry, but he was only going one way. And I was
like... Yeah, that happened to be the wrong way, but...
And I was like, oh, okay. So so it's a bit risky in some places, isn't it? So
it makes it more exciting.
Of course it does.
It makes it way more exciting.
Of course it does. So I know that you said you've not got a massive amount of technical expertise with biking, and you've
done
a few of our podcasts, and I'm really glad that you came. You know, I mean, it's quite late there, and you're mid time, so thank you. But tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in motorcycling.
I grew up in Northern Ireland, as you can tell by my accent. Cars weren't as prominent as they are now. So most people had motorbikes. And there was we used to call them Harry Angel. Now, whether they're Hells Angels or not, I don't know. But they had the big black bikes, loads of chrome, the leather cuts, dirty jeans, long hair, listened to rock music. And then you have the mods and the Vespas and all their wing mirrors and rubbish like that. I was never affiliated with Vespas and rubbish like that. I always liked the big cruisers, the sort of very American, all that. When I left school, I joined the army. Getting home and leave, didn't have a driving license, so we bought Honda 90s for 20 quid. Yeah. Which 20 quid back then was quite a lot of money in the late 80s, early 90s.
And you didn't
really care. You know, the last couple of days of leave, it was ragged around a field anyway. So, but we used to be able to go from Portadown, where I grew up, to Newcastle, the seaside, on a Sunday. What should take 45 minutes? Should take about 3 hours. It was great. You know, and you just bombed along and hope it didn't blow up and fall apart, and you hope your string held and all the rest of it. And then cars become a thing. I got more into cars, and as I was saying earlier, anything with turbo on it, we paid for it, we didn't care. The simple fact it just had a turbo sticker meant nothing. And then for you, because of the type of music I listened to, because of the way I dressed, everybody always thought I was into bikes.
Right.
And I wasn't. You know what I mean? I like bikes. I couldn't walk past a sexy bike and not go, oh, hello. You know what I mean? That was my thing.
Yeah.
I always thought I will get my bike test at some point. And then when I left the army and I was contracting in the Middle East, we sort of set up a bike club.
Right.
Not an MC, just a bike club. All ex-veterans or all ex-soldiers who had the right mindset to ride motorbikes. I didn't have a bike. My mate had a trike made out of his 87 Harley Sportster. He didn't think he was ever going to be able to ride again due to an injury.
Right.
He could. So I bought the trike because I didn't need a bike license.
Yes.
I bought his trike. He then bought an Exile chopper and built it and all the rest. And we run around with the 87 Sportster, as 87 Sportsters tend to do, ripped its own clutch apart. And my wife at the time decided that she'd had enough of me throwing money at this bike. So I didn't last very long. Needed the bike. Well, come to 2013, I was again home and leave, and I said to my girlfriend at the time, now wife, I said, I'm going to do my bike test. So did my bike. I found a place in Swindon. I think we were the last to be able to do from nothing to full license.
Ah, before the progressive EU.
It changed in 2014, didn't it?
Yeah.
I done mine in November. Didn't get rained on. Very happy with that. Because I didn't have all the gear. I think I was wearing a North Face Gore-Tex jacket and a pair of combat trousers or something like that. We'd done our CBT. We then switched up to the 600s. The odd roundabout in Swindon, I happened to really badly do my clutch and pop the wheelie and scared the absolute bejesus out of myself. And I was like, okay, that's more than enough of that. That was on the Wednesday. Fought through, sort of panicking, bit nervous. Went through again on the Thursday. Cause I told him, well, you didn't die yesterday. You'll be fine. Stop being a girl. No offense to anybody. It was in my own head.
Hey, so it's a mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. And I because I'd scared myself, I wasn't really enjoying it as much as I should have been. So on the Friday morning when I was going in and you were doing my test, I said, look, I want to drop back to the 125. And he went, what? I want to drop back to the 125. I'll not pass on a 600. I'm afraid of it. I just need time to build back up to it again. Mm. And he went, well, I'll tell you what, we'll go out. So we went out, me and my instructor went out, and I came back. And he said, well, that was fine. If I was examining you, I'd pass you. I said, well, yeah, that's great. I'd still prefer to do the 125. And he went, you know, we'll restrict you. I said, yes, I know. I've already spoke to Harley. It's fine. I'm happy with that. And he got one of the other instructors to take me out, and he said the same thing. But he said, look, if you're not happy, do the 125. So I did the 125, passed, which I didn't think I had done. The instructor was sort of robocop, and he was dead
face,
bad face. I took my helmet off, only because it stalled. But I'd done everything properly. It sort of stalled on a hill start. Yeah. I'd done everything properly. I'd done everything I was meant to do. Probably overdone lifesavers and all the rest. There's such a thing. I thought I'd failed. We went up to the roundabout, turned around, we're heading back down towards the test centre, and I was like, idiot. Anyway, I'll be booked in tomorrow, it'll be fine, I'll get it done then. And he said, take the next left. I'm like, but you know, I'm sort of in my head going, but the test centre's just there.
Yeah. Why aren't you taking me back?
I failed, I'm among, just send me on my way. So we get back to the test centre. I took my helmet off, threw my gloves and my helmet, put it on my bag. I wasn't overly impressed with myself. And he said, do you want your instructor to come with you? I said, yes. He's got a fix when I've broken. So it was fine. And he said, well, that's your physical part of the test over. Congratulations, you passed. I was like, what?
Are you sure?
I stalled it. She said, yeah, I stalled this morning on the way in. I test people. Yeah. You know, it happens.
We've all stalled the bike.
Yeah, everybody stalls a bike. You know, it's the thing. You know, and that was it. I rode back. The instructor went, right, I'll see you back at the place. Went back to the showroom. Obviously bought a helmet and all gloves and a jacket and all the rest of the gear. Never used it again. I passed my test in November 2013 and never rode a bike again until August 2021.
Wow.
No, July June, July. Yeah, July 21. And that was in Mongolia.
Wow. So tell us about that 6-year gap from passing your test, going on 20125, being a bit spooked by you, the power of that 600, which I can really understand that, you know, when you're first learning.
Yeah.
Then you passed your test, you like didn't think you would, and you got that out of the way, went and bought everything, and then never touched it for 6 years. Then we've skipped forward to Mongolia, and I'm going to wild guess that that would play a part in why you're on this podcast now, because that's quite a big thing, isn't it? So
whenever anybody talks to me about it, I do get very passionate about it, and if you tell me to wait, you know, to sort of calm it down a bit, I'll even try not to swear. My wife is an art teacher, and being a good diligent squatty on a Sunday, I was ironing all my kit, and she came down the stairs in 2020, you know, COVID lockdown, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And she said, "How do you fancy Mongolia?" I was like,
"Is that just out of the blue?"
No, she's been applying for jobs, international teaching jobs.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
She's an art teacher, and I went, "Yeah, go on then. Why not?" You know, not many people get to go to Mongolia,
which
I didn't realize wasn't as true a statement as you'd actually think. But so I went to Mongolia. The traffic in Mongolia is horrendous. It makes Bangkok look like a freeway. You mean it's absolutely mental. It's just gridlocked the whole time. The only way to get through.
And you know, when you say that, it's strange because I bet many people who haven't ridden in that neck of the woods would assume it's this humongous, massive, empty country with about 12 people in it that you see every 3 days.
There's actually 16 people. No, there's actually, it's something like 3 million people. And it is, I remember doing a graphic for one of the teachers. It's something like 14 times the size of the UK.
Right.
Area wise,
yes,
and it is off the top of my head, I think it's a quarter of the content of London live in the entire city or the entire country, with over half of them living in Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital. So it's like 1.5 million people, a bit more, living in a city built for 400,000. And they've all got six.
Everyone's in one place.
And they've all got 6 cars, and they all use them at once. The infrastructure's just not designed for it. It's fantastic. It is chaos in a very sedate, stationary way, if that makes sense.
So when did you arrive in Mongolia? Did you just fly up there with all your worldly goods for your wife to start with?
Yeah, we basically packed up our life, packed up our cottage. It's now all sitting in a garage, waiting to get sifted, because we don't need it. We haven't needed it for 5 years. We don't need any of that stuff. It's only stuff that, if the worst thing happened and we both died today, somebody had to go through a garage full of stuff that we had no real impact on our life, because we haven't touched it. But we arrived sort of mid-July 2020, 3 weeks in a hotel room, and then just in the hotel room, nowhere else. And then we got let loose on Ulaanbaatar. We walked a lot of places, we bussed a lot of places. We did take the odd taxi, but not very many, because they can't drive. Cut to 2021, people weren't, because lockdown had just lifted, people were staying in the country, because the people who had been there the year before, they'd been out riding horses and camping and climbing rocks and doing all sorts of adventure stuff. We've been stuck in the city, going from our apartment to a supermarket and coming back. So a lot of people were staying, and a friend of ours, Tony, who started at the same time as my wife, said, we were sitting talking one night over coffee, and he said, oh, there's work away. So he was going to go up to a farm, sort of, according to Google, it was like 4 hours away. That was fine. He was going to help out there, do stuff. He's an engineer. Right. He can rewire stuff. And we were talking about how he's going to get there. I said, well, you can ride a bike. We can hire bikes. Just get a bike.
Yeah.
And he said, do you know what? That's a bloody good idea. I'll do that. So he came back to me the next day and said, yeah, we've got a bike coming on Thursday or Tuesday. I was like, oh, awesome. Well done. So me and my wife went to breakfast on the Tuesday morning. And we just general chit-chat, what's going on? I said, yeah, Tony's getting his bike on this evening. And Claire went, why don't you get one? I was like, the traffic, and no, I'm good, thanks. I said, oh, don't, such a girl. Get Tony to get, and that was it. My bike arrived with Tony's new chain. We got up the next morning, the Wednesday morning, it was cold and rainy. And we were sort of heading off. And this is our waiting us off. Yeah, bye, see you there. You know, and borrowed a helmet. You know, and I was wearing a little windproof smock. And neighbours are emptying their bins. It was just mental. You know, away I went. And
So this is the first time you'd ridden in anger for 6 years or more, is it?
It was 8 years. But lucky enough, we didn't have to go through the city. We go down, do a U-turn, and go round the sort of outskirts of the city.
Right.
And then we're on it's called the Darkhan Road. They've been building it for 3 years. I think it's finished now. I'm not sure. So according to Google, it was going to take us 4 hours. It took us 10.
Wow.
Because the road wasn't finished. So if any of your riders do ever get to Mongolia, you'll see. In fact, if you look at Google Earth, Google Maps, there's loads of tracks that all end up in the same place because they don't like being told what to do. So they'll go their own way. You got Priuses going up the side of mountains and stuff. It's mental. But it was fantastic. There was no... And because of the horse culture and the evolution from horses and herds to motorbikes and herds, they're very motorbike aware.
Right.
And whenever you're driving into the city and it's bumper to bumper for as far as the eye can see, cars will actually move for you. And you don't expect it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's good.
And as you go past, they'll wave to you and say, cheers. And crack on. So that was fine. We got up there, we had coffee, I needed to realign my back wheel. That's where I fell off, honestly. Nothing to do with skill set and fun, it was to do with my back wheel.
What bike were these that you rented?
Tony had a 600 Tenere and I had a CRF 250, a little Honda.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous bike. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely fantastic little bike.
Yes.
Which I actually got to use again when we done the Racky for our ride. Because it was an issue with Royal Enfield. But my Tony said to me, you're leaving a bit late. It took us 10 hours to get here. It's 12 o'clock now. Are you not going? I said, yeah, I am. I'm waiting so there's no traffic. So all the traffic will be gone. So I can have a free ride in, not having to deal with it by myself, like a big boy. I can just scoot through when it's all quiet. So I was driving down, riding down, all good, until I come down a closed road. And it sent me to the left, so I went round to the left. My Google Maps was telling me, yeah, you're going to get home at the same time. So, okay, fine. What it actually done was, instead of bringing me in through the west of the city, it brought me into the north of the city. And that went right down through the center of the city. And I must have sat in traffic for, initially about 20 minutes. Right. And this is where I seen cars moving. And then somebody's hand came out and went, you know, go on. So I went, you know, sort of split a lane, and I'm like, I've never done this before. Okay. Okay, I'll just stay on the line and just stay between two cars. Got between the two cars. I felt really proud of myself because I didn't die. And neither did anybody else. I was like, okay. Well, okay, I can do that. And they allowed me to do that. Okay, so I'll do that. So I did that. And I shared my location with my wife. And she's there glued to her phone watching where I'm going. And I come down through Sikbala Square. And there's nobody beating their horns at me. Everybody's just moving out of the way. It was like the red, you know, the Red Sea had parted. And people just let me get on with it. It was fantastic. And I honestly, it was one of my proudest moments, riding up into back into the school. And there's my wife. That smiled about here.
Really?
You made it. You didn't die. And then that was it. That was my summer 21 was spent with me going for cups of coffee the long way around on the motorbike.
Right.
I just kept it and then just kept moving, you know. And every so often, Claire would say to me, we need something from, you know, something random and small that we don't actually need, but you need an excuse to go out. So here.
I get it.
Go to Rosewood and get a pint of milk. You know, and I jump on the bike, I let go, come back 2 hours later. You get the milk? Oh, forgot. Okay, I'll go and get some. You mean, and because of the culture in Mongolia, was you mean, unlike the UK, if you go through some, if you got a couple of years go through a village in the UK, sometimes people look at you a bit sternly because it's taken away after a rustic look of the place.
Mm.
Or if you're sitting outside a country pub, people sort of give you that look because you're ruffians. You mean we're not in dirty jeans anymore and leather jackets and all the rest. We've all got.
Speak for yourself.
I mean, well, yeah. Well, I generally am. Are you? But the you mean most people are sitting in.
Yeah.
Over the cost of over the cost of your first car. You know what I mean? The jacket alone, 700 quid. You know what I mean? So, you know, but it was an absolutely fantastic thing. And it was something I really wish I'd done so much earlier in my life. It's that smile. I just thinking about it, I'm smiling. It's that you can't ride angry. You can get on a bike angry. But once you press that button and it starts, that anger goes away.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely fantastic. And
you caught the bug quite late then.
Yeah, I did. And you mean, it's probably just as well we come to Singapore because it is, you mean, it is very expensive to own vehicles here. But in you mean, the whole time in Mongolia, whenever my wife was growing up in South Africa, she was pony club and the manual and stuff, and they talked about step horses. And we got to go on a charity ride in Mongolia. And we went for a test ride. Now, during that summer, I had electric issues because it's very dry out there and electrics don't like it or anything. I had something wrong with seal that kept overheating.
Right.
Again, don't know. So I had my CRF 250, a Tenere, a Transalp, and the Yamaha, it was a 300, no, it was a 400, but it all had the extension tanks put on and lots of extra modding and stuff like that. That was a lovely little bike to run around in, run around on. And, because of my training, I got roped into being a medic for the horse ride.
Oh, from your army?
Yeah. I was a team medic. And when I started contracting, I kept updating it and keeping it up to date. So, well, you're not going to deal with gunshot wounds or traumatic limb loss, you're going to be dealing with nip-nap trivia, chafes and bruising. So I went, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So
Tom, sorry to interrupt, but so you
you were chosen to be sort of the medic because you got that experience.
Yes.
Who chose you, and what was that?
There's a longest charity ride on horseback is the Gobi Gallop, and what it does is it raises money for the Children of the Peak kindergarten, and these kids live on the dump, the municipal tip.
Right.
And it's a 24/7 operation. The kids don't get sleep and all the rest of it. Anyway, Julie, who is an absolute force of nature, try saying no to that woman. It doesn't happen. They do this, and middle-aged women from all over the world come over and ride 700 k's in 10 days on horses.
Wow.
It's bloody hard work. Mm. And they're absolutely knackered at the end of each day.
I bet.
And I generally just handed out ointments and some painkillers. There you go, crack on. And it was great. It let me see something I'd never get to see. I got to see parts of the country I'd never get to see.
How did you get involved in that then? From being there, your wife working, what?
Because the British School of Ulaanbaatar, where the headmaster and his wife were very close with the Valu Foundation. Right. These guys.
Mm.
No advertising, no product placement.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So they were, you know, and then because it was it's 10 days, so the school can't put a whole team in. So what they did that year was put a sort of relay team in. So half the team done the first weekend, half the team done the second weekend.
Right.
So they covered, BSU as a whole covered at least the 700 Ks.
Yes.
And they're up doing a briefing, and for the teachers, how it was all going to work, and said, look, unfortunately, we don't have a medic. We generally have a doctor. We have Suke, who is absolutely fantastic, but as a Mongolian, he fails miserably because he doesn't ride a horse, which comes later on. And my wife, as wives are quite likely to do, my husband didn't do that. Yeah, I got phone and told I was doing that. So I get a phone call saying, can you pop up? Yeah, popped up. And it was like, ah. And I met Judy for the first time. Ah, you're going to be my medic. Oh, okay. Fair enough. I'd probably go for the weekend, but I'm now here for the whole thing. And it's absolutely brilliant. And to see people going beyond, not only beyond their comfort zone, but beyond their own shadow, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Pushing themselves a little bit harder. For people who never ever, well, they'll get to meet them, but not ever see the fruition of their efforts. And, I mean, we put up posts and all the rest of it saying, you know, go beyond yourself. You make a difference one child at a time. They actually do. I can't go back to the dump because it makes me angry, because they're still not kindergarten age but slightly older. There's still kids rummaging around in the dump, and it shouldn't be happening. They should be in school.
Of course.
And we've had one of the things we wanted to do. It doesn't really apply to Mongolia because there's no 1% bike clubs and there are bike clubs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, their leather cuts are like, each bit of leather is like that thick, you know, I mean, it's mental. Looks like a Roman soldiers. Yeah. That's what they look like. They've got that sort of stiffness with them.
Yeah.
They're not very comfortable riding, I imagine. But, you know, typical bike clubs, they're Harleys, they're all polished, they're all clean, and but they're all really nice guys. You know, I mean, nobody gets upset with anybody, and there's no territory or anything like that. But just to play by some sort of rule, we got there's a guy called Banga, and he's an international, world-renowned tattoo artist. and he's the vice president of the Mongol Brotherhood, I think it is. I probably shouldn't get that wrong. So I asked his permission, because we've got our Steel Horse Gallop logo, and I wanted that to sort of back patch, just, you know, a bit like Wild Hogs, you know, it's nothing serious. It's just something cool, if you like that sort of thing. And he said yes, and he was up, you know, he's a quite a stocky guy, bald, sort of big bison head, lovely bloke, and you see him playing with the kids, playing, you know, and they'll bring him up a green bit of Lego and they'll pretend to eat it, and, you know, absolutely fantastic.
Let me take you back a little bit then. So yeah, we're talking about the Wild Horse Gallop.
Yeah.
700k over 10 days.
Yeah.
And
how does that correlate with motorbikes?
Yeah, what made you think, let's do something similar on motorbikes? How did that come about?
I was bored. It's that simple. I was bored. I was sitting in the support truck, because you don't want me on a horse. I was sitting in the support truck, and we're sort of going up. This is like the second or third one I'd done. This is 22, and I'd done the big long ride, because Suki couldn't ride, and there was a point you had to ride a horse, so I got voluntold, I was doing that. I rode a horse up into the mountains, just visited the reindeer people, then rode back down again, got back in the truck, very happy with that. Didn't ride, I held on really hard. So I'm sitting there in the oven truck in the Gobi Gallop, and I'm like, we could do this in motorbikes. I've actually still got the notes on my phone from that. You know, I was sitting in the wagon, just making notes. Oh, we could do that. So that was fine. And we got back. We always have a massive gala. Everybody gets their best frocks on, and then some of the girls put dresses on too. And it's fantastic. You know what I mean? And you are treated like a rock star.
Yeah, right.
Because all these people would love to have done it. One, they don't have the time. Two, they don't have the inclination. But what they do have, pots of money, and we feed them a lot of drink, and they bid.
The fact that you did it and
support. Yeah. You know, they bid on stuff they don't even need by, you know, and it's fantastic. It's a lot of money, and it keeps the lights on, and the kids are safe, and the kids get fed, and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And so that was on the Saturday. So on the sort of Tuesday or Wednesday the following week, I phoned Julie up and I said, do you want to get curry? And she's like, yeah, go on then. Friday night, we'll have a curry. Bring Shelvin, Thursday coming too. Went over to a Mexican restaurant. Best curry in Ulaanbaatar is in this Mexican restaurant. Right. Obviously, why wouldn't there be? And I said, how about we do the Gobi Gallop on motorbikes? Now, I know we talked about it in the past, and she'd been asked. I said, do you think it'll work? Being a good diligent soldier, I had a report. There you go. Read that. In a nice report folder, the whole thing. Yeah. And she went, thought about it then. Yeah, just a wee bit. Your spelling's atrocious, by the way. I know. Don't worry about it. Your grammar's rubbish. Yeah, I know. She used to be an English teacher. Anyway. And she went, make it happen then. She said yes, and I went, okay, it's a real thing now. And that was in September. We all got together. We got together with Zola, whose parents own Horse Track Mongolia, who do all the horse side of things. He wanted to sort of expand the business, and because it was being all lumped in together, he thought, well, I'll give that a go. His brother Sagnar will look after the horses, I'll look after the motorbikes. And I went to Royal Enfield and borrowed a Himalayan, because that's the
they
bike
got a
I decided.
The in Ulaanbaatar.
Second.
Do they have
yes.
a Royal Enfield?
Yeah. It literally where we were in Yarmag. It literally just it hadn't even officially opened. It was open, but it's had a sort of soft opening. Yeah. And the way I sold it to them, you lend me 10 bikes, and you can use this as your launch.
Mm.
And the guy who owns it he went to, or the guy who's got the franchise, he went to BSU, so he sort of said yes. India, you mean, he was keeping bikes for tours anyway. India decided to change his business model. We didn't have bikes. But he wanted to lend me a bike. It was minus 16 whenever I left BSU. And I didn't have a cover on the bike. I had to bump the bike. But I mean, I haven't been riding bikes for years. I put a new to bump a bike. And you know, it seems a car and you fall over more. But it was minus 16 and away I went. And there's a picture, if you go onto the Steel Horse Gallop Facebook page, you go to the very bottom of it, there's a picture of us launching the Steel Horse Gallop. There's the horse, there's Julie, there's Baggy, who taught Julie how to ride, and there's Chinggis. It's the biggest equestrian statue on the planet, I think, like 40 meters tall, stainless steel. And when you go up into it, you can go up and sit on the horse's head. You can ride Chinggis's crutch, like most of the population of the planet did, apparently. One in every 80 people can trace their genes back to Mongolia. It was fantastic. And then we had to sort of get the planning properly. Now, we use the same route as the horses because it's logistically easier to have one cook set, one set of tents. As opposed to us having our own special admin vehicles, so we stayed together, and we did sort of open it up, and then we thought, hang on, we understand the concept, we understand the plan. Let's see, will it work? Because it could be the horse riders don't want motorbikers anywhere near them, bike riders anywhere near them. So. We sort of closed it down. Myself, Zola, and Soybold, who was on the very first Gobi Gallop 10 years before, got on the motorbikes. He's got a lovely little Yamaha, and it's got a clutch button, so he doesn't have to keep dropping. It's an Australian version, right. So they can open the fences, open the gates, right. So they don't have to keep dropping. I mean, finding neutrals generally always a pain in the ass. So you just press this button and it pulls the clutch in.
Yes.
Yeah, it engages the clutch and you get off and away you go. So he had went and done a bit of a recce. So away we went. He loves a bit of water. So we always find water. Loves a lake. And so we literally spent, and there's a picture of the three of us at the Chinggis statue. As well, and we basically spent overnight. We rode up, parked up in this hedge, this sort of foresty bit, pitched tents, had some food, and thought, right, that's day one over. That's pretty awesome. I did try to ride without a helmet, but it's all sandy, and the ass kept going, and I went, yeah, helmet back. Safety first, obviously. We were sort of riding around. We roughly knew where we were going, and we couldn't wait any longer. We needed to meet the women and the horses. So we met them at lunchtime, and that was it. We go off. We done it. We went off in the morning. The horses go off first. We sit about, drink coffee, eat more breakfast. After about 10, 15 minutes after they have gone, we're geared up and away we go. So the three of us rode round and we sort of got to the end. And it was like, well, that's proof of concept. Right, let's launch this properly. That was 23. So 24 comes along and the Royal Enfield guys are, it's not their fault. You mean they've got demands on them. They're not there just to service us. So we needed to come up with a plan. I said, well, just, you mean they're only, the Himalayan's what, $4,000? Buy that. $7,000, whatever. And that's when we sat down and Julie said, right, I can't justify spending money from the foundation that's donated and designed to go to the children on the school.
Yeah.
At the kindergarten. And we're like, okay, let's get the writers to do it then. So I sat and I worked out a sort of plan of charging. I mean, I'd done a route, tried Singapore, too expensive. So there's literally, you go across the bridge, you're in Jorobaru, turn right, walk up the hill, and then walk down a hill, and you're at the Royal Enfield dealership. So with them and the guys from IPO who know the Valois, the family, they know the original Malaysian Tamil family. Mm. We worked out deals, and we got 6 bikes. And the guys pay for the ride. So that was it. The pay for the ride. I buy the bikes, and then the bikes are going into the country. They ended up in Mongolia to be donated. That's fine. We go off on holiday. We go off on Christmas holidays. Go to South Africa, where my brother-in-law has a hobby farm or a farm. It is a farm. There are vines on it. And we went to visit one of Claire's oldest friends in Barrydale, and they have a thing every year called Harleydale. All these gorgeous Harleys. It's every little Northern Irish kid's 7-year-old dream. It's chrome, it's black, there's some awesome tank paintwork, the whole thing. And we ended up through a mixture of Jack Daniels and Coca-Cola with lots of ice. We rented me a bike. We won an auction. And I had a Tagger 900 Raleigh, I think it was, for 3 days. That was a nice bike.
They're very nice.
They are very nice. There was a couple. They're in Spain at the minute. They've got 2 Taggers. And I was just sitting going.
Ken and Sophia.
Yes.
Yes, with the dogs on the bike.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was like, God, they're nice bikes. Yeah. I really, really did enjoy that bike. Then again, I've yet to find a bike that I haven't liked. I'm not a bike
connoisseur.
I'm not a connoisseur. I'm not brand orientated.
Yes.
I'm not a bike snob, that's what I'm not.
Yes. Yeah.
Basically, I'll ride anything as long as it's not a scooter, because if I fall off them, I can't ride a scooter.
Yeah, less stable with those small wheels, you have to be aware.
Yeah, they're just mental. So we were discussing it, and Julie said, right, well, you need to scout your route. I'm like, okay. How to do that? Okay, okay. So I bought my bike in January, and I said, right, well, we know what Mongolia is like. I've ridden down to the China border, or Sanjiang, which was the big, there's a place called Shambhala there. It's a Buddhist monastery place. It's a nice ride out. So we know what that's like. China's taken care of because we've got a guide. The only thing I don't know about is Malaysia to Lao-China border. So I took myself up to, no support wagon, no nothing, just jumped on the bike with my Black Army issued duffel bag thing, strapped it to the back of the bike, and away I went, and I rode up. It was also to test my, it was to proof my timings and the distances. Because I've also done it on Google Maps, and it only gives you so much. You can only get so much in a map recce. So it was a good excuse to test them. And to be honest, and one of the problems we had was going to take 3 weeks. Now, people have work, and I understand that. So we left between 8:30 and 9 every morning. We were generally in the hotel. Oh, this is on the recce. I was generally in the hotel between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. So I give people who had office emails, you know, Wi-Fi in every hotel. It gave them a chance to do that. So that opened the potential rider bracket up. And we got a couple of them. Unfortunately, one of the girls got hurt before she was in Australia. She'd come off her bike and she couldn't do it. She still donated the bike. She didn't want her money back for the bike. And we got somebody else to ride it up for her, which is fantastic.
And did she fully, is she okay now?
Oh, yeah. It was just she broke her ankle. Mm-hmm. It was her ankle. But it was the left ankle. So had it been the right ankle, we could have probably talked her into it. But left ankle, you sort of need that for gear changes.
Pretty much, yeah.
One of the guys, an American guy, he decided that he didn't want it because it was always ever only a bike delivery ride. It wasn't a holiday.
No.
It was get from A to B to C. And because I was posting every night when I got into the hotel, I'd strip off, ruin another set of white towels because I only had an open face. I don't like, so I've got an open face on motorways. One set of towels in every hotel was ruined.
But did you have all your gear in your Bergen then? Is that
what? Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I just strapped.
Did you do okay?
I just strapped to the back of the bag and cracked on. As you do. There was no point overthinking it.
If I'd overthought it,
it would have went wrong.
Oh, great innovation. So, it's amazing.
On the way through, I had my Scrum 411, two panniers, and my black issued bag that carried my desk with my computer in it, a couple of pairs of shorts, a couple of t-shirts. I've got more Royal Enfield stuff here than I have my own clothes because they kept giving us stuff. Oh, here, I have a t-shirt. You know, yeah, cheers, thanks, man. It was fantastic. The only scary part was on Google, in Southeast Asia, on Google Maps, there's the bike option because you're not allowed on every motorway. That's now, when I got stopped in Bangkok and fined, they were talking about $5,000 fine and confiscating my bike because I didn't have this. I didn't have that variant on my phone.
Yeah.
Now it comes and goes. I don't need it in Singapore. If I go across the bridge, it pops back up again. It's fantastic. Lucky enough, the traffic police they've got a parachute on their thing, on their badge.
Yeah.
I went, "You are born." He went, "Yes, I parachute." "Me too." I don't, but look, I'm the last time I jumped over. That got me through, and that was fine. So I went up to Laos, I got through Thailand, went through Bangkok. Bangkok was a bloody nightmare. But I will say, if anybody gets a chance and they don't want something big, a Scrum 411 Royal Enfield will, I could wring my socks out. When I got to the hotel in Bangkok, the heat of the engine, so my feet were just sweating, and it not a single bit of trouble on that bike. So I went up, got myself out of Bangkok, was very happy, sat in the Starbucks on the outskirts, had a brew, and headed up the road. If anybody ever wants to go and ride, Thailand is one of the best places.
Amazing.
It's fantastic, because they're completely geared up for motorbikes, whether you're on a highway or whether you're on a local road.
I've got a great video of being stood at a junction in the middle of Bangkok. I think it was Sukhumvit 20, where the flyover, you know, the LRT thing is.
Right, yes.
There's about 4,000 bikes with me set off. And I thought, well, the lights must have gone, because I stood at the red light. And I thought, well, the lights must have gone green. No, there was just a gap in the traffic. So about 4,000 set off.
Everybody went.
So I went with them, and then the traffic come from both. I was like, they've all ignored the light. No, we'd gone on the red light.
It's mental. It's, you mean, it's insane. And, I mean, as I said, we were, got up, got through Thailand, some fantastic hotel. And because I was by myself, I found that hotel staff who are generally paid to be friendly. Yeah. These guys were fantastic. Everybody, nobody gave me a hard, there was no hard time given. There was no, you know, looking at me in any strange way.
No.
Apart from, you doing what? You mean, it was short. Well, you're driving up to the Chinese border, and then coming back down again. Yes, I'm doing that. That's what I'm doing. And they went, okay. Absolutely brilliant. Some absolutely gorgeous roads. Nice, big sweeping corners. Which reminded me a lot of South Africa. I love riding bikes in South Africa. It's just fantastic. Nice sweeping corners.
Mm.
Absolutely lovely. And I got to Lao. Tourist tax, all the rest of it. Okay, fine. Went in, got to my hotel, rode up, probably one of the worst roads I'd ridden on in the whole trip. I had the choice of the front of one of two lorries. One lorry was overtaking the other one on a corner, going up a hill. So he had bags of maneuverability, or I had a pothole. I hit a pothole. I chose the pothole.
Probably the best.
I can at least deal with that. That's not going to kill me, possibly. They definitely will. So I picked the least likely. So hit this pothole really hard. Thought, bollocks, that's not good. But that being mechanically minded, I sort of got out on my hand. I felt the tire was tubed, so I was happy with that. Had it been a tubeless tire, it would have been a completely different story. Still solid, happy days. Run my hand around the one side of the rim.
Mm.
Right, happy with that, let's go. So away I went, got to the hotel, stayed in the hotel, got up next morning and went and checked out the vehicle side, vehicle side of the Chinese border. Right, I know where I'm going, let's head south again. So headed south and went back to the village by the Mekong. I mean, going across the Mekong was fantastic. It was such a sort of bucket list. You know, growing up with all the Vietnam movies, and you hear about the Mekong, and to actually cross the Mekong River was fantastic. Sitting beside it, having a beer in the evenings was even better. Went back down through Thailand. On the way back through Thailand, I went down to see a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in 16 years from working together in Afghanistan. He runs, he's a manager of the Thai Asian Queen in Pattaya. Cold beer, went where he went, and a mate. So I took a day off. I had another day off at that point. And it was fine. Then heading back, bit of hassle getting out of Bangkok, because again I didn't have the bike option, and I was going up, and they were trying to send me to the traffic police were brilliant. I stopped, went over, and I said, look, my phone's telling me to go here, I'm not allowed to go there.
Mm.
So I was explaining to them I knew the rules.
Mm.
My phone was wrong, not me. My phone was wrong.
Follow it blindly.
Yeah. And I want their help to stick to their rules.
If you ask like that, they're going to be very helpful, usually.
They couldn't have been more helpful. Absolutely brilliant. They sent me on, and I was riding around, And obviously, Google Maps is trying to update and all the rest of it. I ends up going about 15, 10, 15 minutes later. I ends up going back up the same ramp and stopping at the police. They're all standing there smoking, and they see me. And I'm like, "Hey guys, I missed the turn. Which one is it again?" And then they showed me and all the rest of it. So I finally got to where I needed to get to. Coming back down, got through Thailand, and back into Malaysia, stopped in Ipoh. I was probably doing 350, 400 kids a day. Stopped in Ipoh, and the guy said, "You know, your rim's broke." I'm like, "What?" It was like another, you know, I'd done 3,000 Ks on a busted rim, but it slowly got worse.
Oh,
so I said, do you have a spare one? Do you have one? Can you get one off one of the shop, the one of the display models, and give me it? I don't mind paying for it. He said, we don't have one. So away I went, and I got into KL. Stayed in a lovely apartment. Because I was also checking out where we were going to be staying, the whole thing. You know what I mean, where we stopped, was there laundry, what the food was like, was there a bar, you know what I mean, all that carrying on. Stuff, you know what I mean, where we travellers need to know. And I went down, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, went down to the car park and scratched off the powder coating off the rim, and there it was, cracked. I was like, "Oh, this is not going to be, it's not going to go well." But I planned to be home in the Sunday, but this is Friday. Well, it's Friday at this point. And I was three and a half, 4 hours away from JB. And I was like, "I'm going to go." So as I rode out of KL slowly, I was looking for somebody with a spot welder just to put a spot in the metal rim. Didn't find one. But I'd spoke to the guy in JB, the guy at Royal Enfield in Ipoh, and he said, "As long as you'll do it over 120, you'll be fine." I'll tell you now, a Scrum will do over 120, but doesn't like it. They're not the same. You're not going to be breaking land speed records anytime soon.
Just remind me again where JB is for our listeners.
JB is, you've got Singapore as the island.
Yes.
You've got a couple of land bridges.
Yeah.
And JB is literally the other side of the bridge.
I see.
It's like north of Singapore because Singapore's a city country.
Yeah, exactly.
It's north by about 300 metres, 400 metres.
Right.
But it's Malaysia.
Yeah.
And you can buy chewing gum in Malaysia. You can't buy it here. It's illegal. And when you come back over, unless you've got, if you've got chewing gum, they will find you. It's insane. They'll stop you and check you. They will find you. I got there, I got back, all the rest of it. So that was it. You know, one of the Americans who pulled out decided, "You know what, I'm going to come on this." And with two Americans, two Australians, and a Canadian Dutch guy. And they all arrived in, and they're in the hotels, they got their bikes, and it was all very exciting. Until we got through Malaysia, I got into Thailand. Now, before I lost my original Facebook account, I was following this couple who were riding around Southeast Asia in a Sprinter.
Right.
And I didn't watch the episode where they went back. They went somewhere, Miramar, I think.
Are they sort of a middle-aged couple?
Yeah.
I've been watching them, yeah. I've been following them.
When they went through into Thailand,
yeah,
you're on a British passport, yeah, you're only allowed to go into Thailand by land twice without a visa. Yeah. I didn't know that. Until I got there for my third time.
Mm.
And I had no visa. And of course, at the border, there's nowhere to go buy a visa.
No.
Why not? You're like, "Well, we're going to get one." So I had to sort of leave my guys. We did have representatives of the foundation in the support truck. lovely Ari and Moogie. So they sort of took them to the, which a place that happened to be one of my favourite hotels. I had to go down to Georgetown, get a visa, and then I was coming back. Got to the place, I got about 10 past 12 and so we stopped taking visas at 12 o'clock. I said, oh, come on, sweetheart. It's for the kids, you know, the whole thing, sweating like a par on a smelling test. I was like, it's for the kids. I started up a phone out, showing the pictures of all the kids. And she went, oh, no, I can't help you. Yeah. My computer has already moved on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's moved on from the accepting to issuing. And I can't move it back. So she said, you can fly there. So my bike ended up getting low-loaded, back up to the border. The Zulu and his guys came down, picked up the bike, took it to the next location. I flew into Bangkok, and it's obviously a dream, you know what I mean? And then I had to get a taxi down for about 3 hours, a 3 hour trip down in a taxi. Although the taxi driver decided to drive 3 hours the wrong way. So I got woke up. Hello, guy. Oh, just woke up then. I goes 3 hours the wrong way. I said to him, like, you've got where I need to be. Yes, good. I'm gonna go to sleep. Because I haven't slept yet. And I just woke up. I'm surrounded by trees, and somebody asking me for money through the driver's window. I'm like, right, hold on. How's this? Where are we? So I grabbed my phone, Google Maps. I'm like, dude, what are we doing here? We should be here. We've been on the go for 3 hours. We should be here, not here. So it became a complete cluster. I got there in the end. I mean, I got there about 10 o'clock. And it was. It was all part of the adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we headed up with a nice day off, got our doobie done, all the rest of it. Got into Laos again, and we didn't have the right paperwork, apparently. We don't need paperwork. We're British, we're American, we're Canadians, we're Australians. We don't need a visa to enter your country. But you're on Motivex. So what? There's nothing on your website that says, I need a visa to take a motorbike in. You need a carnet. No, it don't. Your company doesn't recognize them. Don't need it. Don't have it. Well, you can pay me to issue a bit of paper. The bit of paper went in my sort of bum bag that I wore across from them. Mm. As they do here, as is the style here. It went in there and it hasn't come out since. That was 8 months ago.
Nice donation.
But somebody's got a nice soap about that. As I went back, I said, right, how much is this going to cost? 4 million. Okay. I goes down to the ATM, talk amongst yourselves, guys. I goes down to the ATM. There's two different machines, both look like the ATMs. I put it in one, there's something to do with locals checking in. I was like, oh, the ATM's not working. Okay. And then the guy said, you want money? I said, yes, please. And he went, use that one. Oh, okay, fine. Goes in. Because I'd left so quickly, he went, I can only put 3 names on each page here. We need 2. Well, write me out 2 then. He told me it's 4 million there. 4 million. Write me out 2. Oh, it's 4 million each page. Well, for a printed F4 bit of paper, are you joking me? Anyway, so we got through that. Never needed it again.
No.
The other guy, Tom's got it very nice. He hopefully he'll have his framed by now. It's just a nice reminder. And then we got to the Chinese border, the one I was worried about. And the if you're ever going to China expat travel, these guys are miracle workers. Absolutely fantastic. We even had our own border post.
What were they called again, Tom?
China expat travel.
Right.
Absolutely fantastic. I've planned another trip, and I'm only using them. And they might sound expensive, but I'm in Singapore. I've got Chinese travel agencies here.
Mm.
And I spoke to them face to face. And the expat guys are way cheaper. Well, not way cheaper, but they are cheap. There's fixed prices, I think. And it's, I don't know, $6,000-$7,000 a head or something like that.
Right.
And the fact you're only using one guide means nothing. It's still $6,000-$7,000 a head, whatever it is, depending how long you're there for. But yeah, and they're absolutely brilliant. There is issues with getting, because certain parts of China, you're not allowed on the highway.
Yes. Yeah.
Like if you come off and go to the hotel and come back on again, you sometimes have an issue getting back onto the highway because you're not allowed on that region's bit of highway. You can ride through it from the other region to the next region, but you can't join it. That was generally dealt with by Edward, our guide, and it generally just involved him shaking his hand, saying something, and waving us on. There was never, we got stopped by the police once because one of the guys rides in Australia, rides enduro. So there's a lot of standing, and he's just comfy standing. He spent most of the 3 weeks standing on his motorbike. The Chinese didn't like that, so they pulled them over and gave them a bollocking and all the rest of it. We got to go to places that Westerners had. There was a 7-year-old woman who had never seen a blue eye in real life.
Wow.
And she kept trying to touch it. Please don't do that. I need that. You take a picture. Don't poke. And her granddaughter spoke perfect English. And this is in the ass end of nowhere in China. Her granddaughter was basically her interpreter. And her granddaughter was like 8, 9, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was, we stopped one night and we were riding along through this local road, run the gauntlet with lorries. And we were like, the sat-nav was telling us it's a K away, it's 500 meters away. Where is this place? And all of a sudden, boom, city. It's just all high rise,
torrent
of the river, thing. And then boom, a city.
Hard to visualize it, isn't it?
Yeah, it was mental. Went in, got our keys, me and one of the other riders, we went out to have a filthy cigarette, and we were sitting there. And all of a sudden, there's a crowd. And then a police SWAT team arrived. Not because of us. They just happened to be going past and wanted to see what was going on. It wasn't like, they're out, what are you doing? And
yeah, yeah.
There was none of that. They were sort of a bit stern to start with. And then they seen a load of Westerners and went, and they all got the picture taken and they went on. You know, and it was fine. They'd never seen Westerners there before. Wow. And it was after the same.
And what city was this in? You remember?
I should know that. I've got no idea. I should know that.
Don't worry, we can put it on
the but if anybody ever wants to go to China, do it. It's fantastic. You don't have to agree with the government's policies or any of the rest of it. It won't affect you. You'll go, you'll enjoy, and the food is fantastic.
Yeah.
Nothing like your local Chinese restaurant. Nothing at all. You might get chicken fried rice, that's about it. And then we got to Mongolia, and the girl asked me for my car now, the bikes, and I'm like, your company doesn't recognize them. Your company doesn't need them. Oh, okay, fair enough. I'm like, where do you even get that from? It's not part of your thing. We sat there for 7 hours because nobody knew what to do with this.
Googling what to do.
Yeah, well, no, because nobody had ever ridden bikes into Mongolia to donate them.
Oh, of course, they wanted their bike to take back out, usually.
Yes, yeah, or go through into Russia or whatever.
Yes.
The customs guy, the army guy, very helpful. The girl who was there, she was absolutely brilliant. And we had a nice relaxing time, met everybody else. And the bikes were in Mongolia. I, It was very dusty, shall we say. As we rid out of the border crossing, I did feel my lip quiver, because it was something I'd thought about and then got to do it. And then we had the bikes had to get sorted out, and then we started the very first open to the public steel horse gallop.
And so when you arrived in Mongolia,
yeah,
you were donating the bikes to raise funds.
For the Valu Foundation.
So what were you donating them? Who to, and what were they doing?
We actually donated them to the Valu Foundation. The Valu Foundation owned them.
Right.
Because it's a proven concept and now actually done.
Yeah.
Like the horses pay a penny. Bikes not so much. So we donated the bikes to the Valu Foundation. So every year, with the Gobi Gallop, we can do the steel horse gallop. Yes.
Yes.
So we didn't have to spend the foundation didn't have to spend money on the bikes.
Okay. Great.
And run the risk of breaking the charitable rules, covenant, whatever, and losing its charitable status.
Of course.
That was it. And then we got the bikes all sorted out. And then we had our riders come in. And absolutely, from a concept to actually standing there, watching these people run their hands lovingly, tenderly over their new bikes, their steel horses for the next 10, 11 days, was phenomenal. Absolutely. And, there's me, grew up in Portadown, on the banks of the Ban, all those years ago, and here I am, supplying bikes for a charity in a country that I never ever thought I'd get to.
Right.
And it's just a country that I'll always want to go back to. And we had riders of all skill levels. One of the girls, Julie, fantastic rider, had done a couple of Nepalese trips, I believe. I think she was one of the only people that didn't fall off. With the plumber and his wife, Julie, who had literally got her bike license 2 days before they got on a plane. Now, where we stay, we took them out for a couple of days to get everybody used to the bikes and check themselves out and all the rest of it. There was a little, it wasn't even being as high as this, that door sort of held. She wouldn't go up it or down it. 3 days later, she's going through a rock field, sort of kickstart style, jumping around things. Her new confidence level went to there. She'd come off, she'd been injured. She just cracked on with it. The last week, the last 5 days, you do ride for 5 days, have a day off. The last 5 days, I had 2 cracked ribs. I'm kind of hoping, because Zola's in the support wagon, I said to him, next year, we have a dash cam. Because some of my spills were quite spectacular, and I want them on camera. Again, it's skill and fun.
Yeah.
If they're out of balance,
it's called adventure.
Something's going to end up on the floor. Generally, me. But it was fantastic to see those guys, even the guys who had bags of experience, found challenging bits on it.
Mm.
And even though the bits they didn't necessarily find overly challenging, they really enjoyed it because there's no fences. There's no real roads. There's tracks. You want to stay on the track, stay on the track. If you want to go left of the track, right of the track, you want to cut that corner off, just do it. And the good thing about, because you pick the 411s, they don't churn up a very delicate ecosystem.
Yes, they're quite light, aren't they? Thank goodness.
Yeah, they're quite light. When we go back this year, I'm kind of hoping I've got new tires. Because I my my scrum done in total 15. You know, I'll stop ahead. But 15,500 Ks. Same chain, same tires. Because they didn't change the front tire whenever they changed the rim.
Yeah.
They took my tire, my tube, bin the old rim, put the new rim on, and put my stuff back on again.
You mentioned about next year or this year, what the next year. Can you tell us? What can our listeners and viewers know about what's coming up for the next
year? I just grab a bottle out of the fridge.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no worries.
Sorry about that. Right, yes. So this year, there was going to be a long ride to get more bikes. But it's not happening now. That's been pushed to 26.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, we were pretty full, but a group of people, a collective group, have decided that, you mean, there's a couple of them have stuff going on, and they all want to go together, so none of them can make it. That's fine. So we do have spaces now.
Right.
And the plan is, everybody tips up on, this hasn't been confirmed, so, but we will start on the 2nd of June. The gala is on the 15th.
Okay.
The gala is awesome, actually. It's worth all the pain and suffering and chafing and bruises just to go to the gala, because you get to wear a sparkly frock and you people hand you a drink all over the place. It's fantastic. And it's 11 days in there. You fly into the UB, you get picked up, go to the hotel, we'll go to Star Point, do 5 days, have a rest day. If we can, if we do end up mileage or cares wise down due to weather or whatever, we use that rest day as a sort of a make up day.
Yeah.
Generally doesn't happen. You're generally just sitting about in your pants, feet in the river, having a beer. At some point, a Mongolian will light a fire, it'll get massive, and there'll be more beer. And we all just sit around and giggle like 5-year-olds. We were very concerned about how the bike rider or how the horse riders would interact with the bike riders, because they're 70 Ks and seem in their own place, chafed and sore and all the rest of it. It couldn't have been. If you'd have thought best case scenario, you wouldn't have come up with actually what it was, because everybody wanted to know what everybody else was. You know, what your day was like. What was your day? And nobody got. You know, everybody gets tired, and everybody understands people get tired. So if somebody's tired and quiet, are you okay, mate? Yes. Okay, fine. You're tired. You want to be quiet? We'll let you jump in anytime you want. It's fine. There's no pressure. You don't have to. It's not organized fun. It's just. People just got off the horse, brushed their teeth, went to bed.
Yeah.
And slept. You mean, some of the riders, the bike riders done that thing. So this year we're out on the west side of Ulaanbaatar, or the west side of the country. I haven't actually seen the route yet. There was a proposed route done, I think it was end of September, which was the horse route. Now, what will happen in March-ish, they'll go and do another recce, but the bikes will go, the bike, soil builder, or guide will go with them, Zola will go with them, and they'll then create the bike variant. So we're all at the same evening stops and lunch stops and all the rest of it. As I said, we've got about six places. if they go on to the Facebook page, the Steel Horse Gallop, there's a link there to the well, message me, ask me any questions you want. There's no such thing as stupid questions, as long as somebody learns something. And that's not a challenge. The links there. There is a. It's not a commercial thing. It is a charitable thing. There's a $500 sort of booking fee, which is non-refundable. Then there's the ride fee, which is $4,500, or about $3,000.
Yeah.
And then you're meant to raise $4,500 through, and what the girls in the office, who are absolutely fantastic, and it shocks me, it's Mongolia. You mean you don't expect people to actually know how to use computers? What the girls in the office do is wizardry. They just make it work. They're absolutely gorgeous. And from the soles of their feet to the tops of their heads, deep inside, they're just good people. And the office manager, Miriam, if she gets a bone, stand by. Somebody's, you know, she traveled 4 hours just to tell a customs guy, you mean, we need to do this. And she told him, you mean, she understood it. She was doing her, she was doing his job. Absolutely, and she takes care of all the gala and all the paperwork and all the rules. And they set up the so say you applied to do the Steel Horse Gallop. What happens is we have a chat, myself, Julie, and Zola. Sometimes Soybull, depending where he is, whatever he's doing. And we, you know, there's usual questions, you know, what's your, we basically ask the questions that are on the application form. Because on paper, I sound fantastic. Reality, I'm a nightmare. You know what I mean? So, as most people are, you know, it's all
about why we interview people for jobs.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what we don't want is somebody to get there, be in the ass end of nowhere,
yeah,
and become a hand grenade. We don't want that.
No, of course.
That just ruins it for everybody. Yeah. And you mean we do have the option? Sorry, mate, it's not working. That car for you, you're going home. You mean it's not that, and it has to be for the greater good.
Yeah, I mean, if people were disruptive or they were, danger, for example, you'd have to have these contingencies that it's not good to talk about. We try not to, but the reality is
because it makes it sound all contrived and all the rest of it. It's not. It has to exist. It has to exist, and I don't think anybody would expect it not to exist.
No,
in this day and age, you're in. So you have your interview. We say goodbye. We stay on. We have a chat. And at the minute, I don't think we've had, because everybody's so we do the same. Julie does the same for the horse riders.
Right.
And because everybody's in the same mindset. I love horses. I love motorbikes. I like collecting stamps. Whatever. It just makes it. You mean everybody just wants it to work? Why would you fly to the others, to the most extreme place on the planet, just to be a dick? You mean it?
Yeah, it's very unlikely.
It's a very niche. It's a very unique club that you end up becoming part of. You've ridden the motorbike. Don't get me wrong, there are other companies that will provide motorbikes that are serviced by some guy that knows somebody's cousin. Ours are serviced by Royal Enfield. Haska and Daggy are 100% behind our endeavours. And the general, you know, the if I whenever I was there, I stayed there for a couple of weeks. I'd bring my bike in, and the motherwell else was on the rack, and my bike would take priority. We want our bikes on the ground, because we've got them decaled up, and it shows their bikes such with our stuff on them. You know what I mean? And it makes it look good for them. That's, you know what I mean? So you go on to the Facebook page, and you go on the Horseback Mongolia, look for the rides, and it's all self-explanatory there. We do ask for sort of references, but you mean, yeah, well, he didn't crash, didn't kill anybody, didn't add to the planet, didn't take away from the planet. What more can you get like?
What we can do, if you don't mind sending me the links to both the initial website, the Facebook, so we can put them
yes.
notes for people on YouTube and on the audio versions of this, which should be on Apple Podcast, etc.
Okay, yes, I'll get them over to you, because I've actually got them open at the minute.
That'd be wonderful if you could do
it. I'll just copy it and send it to you. If anybody... it's not like you're going to the Outer Mongolia. Actually, you are. This is our old phrase. It's not like you're going to the Outer Mongolia. No, you are.
Yeah.
You're going to go to one of the most... In the city, it's quite modern. You know what I mean? I didn't know. I thought I was going to end up in somewhere like Kabul, like Afghanistan. You know what I mean? Sort of backward, sort of... Not even mud huts, because they don't even have mud huts. They have yurts. Gurs, the proper version. Yurts are Russian. But they have tents. Yeah. And people actually live in them in real life. Yeah. And they actually prefer living in them to proper houses with heating and running water and stuff. Because they're... It's just the way... It's the most obvious... But it's unspoiled.
Yes.
It's, you mean, there are, whenever we see, when you're out riding about, you will see a herder herding his horses or his sheep or whatever he's got. He's on the back of his horse, he's got a big stick and he's got his meat on their saddle or whatever. You mean, he's doing it as per Genghis did it.
Thousands of years ago, yeah.
Genghis's army done it in the 13th century. This is how they did it. That worked for them. This is how we're doing it. And that works for them. Now, if you're going past, if any of your listeners say, do you know what? I could sit on a beach and go to Gary Lineker's bar in Magaluf. I could do that. Or I could go and do something outside of my comfort zone. So I enjoy riding motorbikes. Happy days. The missus likes riding horses. She can do that.
Yeah,
you mean, which is one of the reasons why we do it together. So last year we had Richard and Alicia, father and daughter. Alicia was on the horse, Rich was on the bike, and it was great. They both had stuff to do during the day, I actually think it brought them closer together. You mean, not that they're estranged or anything like that.
No, but I can imagine it did. Yeah, it was a lovely experience to share with your daughter.
Exactly. If my daughter rode horses, she can come along.
So, in preparation for this, you've done so much background work and experienced it already. Would you mind giving us some, just repeat the names of the different, so people can quickly have a listen to, so the name of the adventure for the horses originally, and then the name of the bike version. And then, you know, we can add them to the show notes before we end the show tonight.
Yes. Yeah. Right, the foundation itself, the charity itself, is the Valu Foundation. And that's who we do That's how we get to do all this cool stuff.
Yeah.
And 12 years ago now, the Gobi Gallop was the horse version. It was formed, and it was done for the first time, and has been done. This will be its 13th year. Could be wrong. Oh, could wow. be 12th.
Yeah.
It's 13th year, something like that. And there's been dozens and dozens of riders from all over the world come to Mongolia. It's the oldest horse culture, so it's where it started.
Mm.
And then we've got the steel horse gallop, which is the motorbike version, the fun version. You know, yeah. Not the serious stuff version. It is the fun version. I don't care.
Fantastic.
It is. I have way more fun. I spend more on a motorbike than I do on a horse.
So, guys, so we've been listening to Tom. Tom Allen is in Singapore at the moment. And we've been talking about the Steel Horse Challenge, which is going to...
Steel Horse Gallop.
Steel Horse Gallop, which is going to take place again next year. And
this year.
2025.
Yeah, 25.
Yeah. Okay, great, yeah. Oh, it was last year you didn't do one, wasn't it? Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah.
And you can go on the Facebook page. You can look for that. There's going to be links in the show notes at the bottom, both on the podcast and on the YouTube video of this. You'll be able to have a look at that, and then you'll be able to contact Tom with any questions you've got. What an adventure. And what a way of sharing, you know, your good fortune to be able to both ride through these countries, have this amazing adventure, as Tom's been telling us about during this podcast, and also raise money for these children who...
Some of the most disadvantaged kids.
Yeah, you know.
You mean, whenever we first started, the actual thing was hashtag poor Tom. Because I got to do all this cool stuff, so
lots of us go on these adventures. Lots of us, you know, have shared our adventures on these podcasts, and people ride around the world. Usually, finances, except for a very few lucky people who, you know, are very lucky to have a few million viewers on YouTube, have to finance it themselves.
Yes.
You know, this way, not only are you having that adventure, but you're raising money for...
And, you mean, the money's donated, and it's, you know, it all stays in Mongolia.
Yes, yeah. It's a very noble thing, and I think it sounds amazing. And we'll definitely, I can see the notes coming through from you, Tom, whilst to speak, so thank you. And I'll put them on the bottom of that. So anybody who wants to contact Tom, please do so using these show notes. If you want to put your experiences of riding in this area, part of the world, please do so in the comments below on the YouTube, or contact us on the Motorcycling Radio podcast, and we can pass on any information onto Tom if you'd prefer to do it that way. So, Tom, I just want to thank you very, very much for being a guest.
Absolute pleasure.
I know it's getting late there, so thank you so much. And hopefully you'll get some interest, and at the very least, people will you know, get in touch with you, and it'll help you to both have some participants and
so.
Life and raise some money and get that money into that much needed part of the world. So
yes,
so much.
To be honest, you'll have bragging rights for years.
I bet. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Right, well, thank you very much, guys. And I'll say, you weren't getting bike porn. I'm sorry if I bored the life out of you. I do get a bit enthusiastic. I get that. Thanks very much for listening, and thank you.
Thank you. And we'll speak.
Happy New Year and all the rest of it.
Sure.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye-bye. Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed listening to and watching this latest motorcycle radio podcast. You might notice that it's now dark. It's 5 hours later. Actually, it's not. We know what, that's how time flies. We videoed this and recorded this at 12 midday UK time. It's now 7:51, so almost 8 hours later. Just finished editing and just about to publish this podcast. But guess what? That's 8 hours. That's a day's wage free. I do not monetize this channel. It is a voluntary thing. When you like and subscribe to other channels, and I'm not suggesting you don't, that's amazing, because it gets them up there for you to watch. You're often supporting a business. This is not a business. This is a voluntary service to allow you and me, motorcyclists and people with an interest in motorcycles and motorcycling, to learn about other people's adventures and to watch and listen to them. It's entertainment, it's fun, and it's something I love to do. It's done literally for the love of it. So I have had to buy software, microphones, cameras, and lots of licenses to ensure that the podcast can be produced and YouTube channels can be submitted, as well as the licenses for the digital video software. So I'm simply asking, if you've enjoyed it, please, please, please like and subscribe. Click the little bell which notifies you when the next video is on. It's about once every week. You'd be really supporting us. And please leave a 5-star review. It simply means that on the algorithms, however they work, because I'm really not sure, I'm not a techie person, I'm a motorcyclist, YouTube pushes it further up there. They've made it clear to me that that people who throw thousands of pounds at it and, you know, beg people for reviews are going to get pushed up that algorithm. And that's great. People have got the money to do that, and people, you know, wish to do that. That's fantastic. But we need to do the same. But this is a voluntary thing. We don't have thousands of pounds to throw at anything. So please like, please subscribe, please leave a review, and please share and tell your friends all about it. And above all, please comment if you've got any questions about any of our guests, or you've got any questions about the channel, or if you'd like to appear on the channel because you would like to share your motorcycling life or experiences, no matter how mundane you might think it is. You'd be really shocked about how many people love the fact that this channel isn't specific to one type of motorcycling. It's not just about adventures, it's not just about one thing. It's about people who might, if you're in America, wrench on a bike or get a spanner out in the UK, or ride a bike to work, or renovate bikes, or they're a mechanic, or they just love bikes in general. You don't have to have a particular niche to appear as a guest or to love this channel. So please like, please subscribe, please share, and please comment. And it'll just help us be out there so other people can enjoy it. I'd really appreciate it. And thanks for listening. I really, really do appreciate it. Thank you. Have a great day.